Welcome to episode 59 of Industry Misinterpretations with James Robertson. This is part two of my conversation with Stephen Travis Pope that I recorded a week ago. In this episode, we continue our conversation about Siren and the early history of Smalltalk. If you have feedback on this or any other episode, please send it to smalltalkpodcasts@syncom.com, head on over to the Industry Misinterpretations group at Facebook, or head on over to iTunes and leave a review, or Podcast Alley and cast a vote. And this week's music was produced by Stephen Travis Pope with his Siren Music System.
The other thing, I think, since we were talking about SWG and external interfaces, we keep having applications where people want to interface to scripting languages or to other graphical tools, or I don't know if you guys know about Super Collider and some of the other languages that are sort of Smalltalk sibling languages for digital audio.
In that domain, I don't personally know what they are. I mean, when you say scripting languages, to be honest, I think of more the languages that come to my mind when you say scripting are Ruby and Python and Perl and those kinds of things. Mm-hmm. So, you know, are these kind of, obviously for a more application-specific domain, but are these kind of mentally similar to that?
Yes, except for that they're really built to be lighter weight and with a focus on real-time processing and concurrent processing. So languages like SuperCollider and Lua are getting heavy use in audio signal processing because they have the flexibility and ease of programming of a scripting language, so it's not like writing in C, but you have these concurrent languages that are very fast and have very good garbage collectors. And the abstraction, more abstraction than something like Python or Tickle or Ruby, because they really are, they're both pretty heavily based on Smalltalk, so you have collection hierarchies and keyword message sending instead of C syntax. So we've been doing a lot of interfacing between our code and Smalltalk, sending messages over the Open Sound Control protocol, which is just it's a protocol where a server publishes an address space of basically knobs like you would have on a synthesizer or on a mixer. And then certain messages say, change this parameter by this value or plug this audio into that input, and allows clients and servers on networks to pretty easily connect. And a lot of people have been using Siren together with SuperCollider because the code looks almost the same, and just the audio stuff you do in SuperCollider, which doesn't actually run its compiler and virtual machine at real time. The runtime is really just running your signal processing graphs.
So your communication with these scripting languages right now is kind of RPC based.
Well, SuperCollider is a UDP based protocol, but you're updating. You create a graph somewhere, and then you send parameter updates to it. So it's not like a remote procedure call, but it is, in fact, going over the network through object servers like RPC would, yes.
Yeah, I guess if I had to answer that the way probably one of our engineers would, I don't know if this is the right answer, but it seems to me that the way that they would probably recommend talking to something like that would be to build an OpenTalk adapter for it. And I don't know if... Honestly, I don't know enough about UDP communications to know whether that's appropriate. Actually, OpenTalk does have open UDP capabilities, so I guess it could be done. It's not the sort of thing that I'm much of an expert on. My expertise in that kind of communication is more at the very, very high level that I've gotten systems talking before, but I don't do the low-level side of that at all.
Well, see, that's what I was doing a lot in early Smalltalk. The reason I actually originally got sent to work on the Sprint project was they just said, we just need somebody to come in for a week or two and write us some proprietary socket protocols to talk from the Smalltalk stuff to this other stuff. So I went there, and that was, what I had done frequently. So that's why Park Place sent me. And then it turned out they had a much bigger problem than that. But it was kind of in the days, Corba was getting accepted, but not everybody wanted to use it for every app, or a lot of Corba apps have components or services that are non-Corba where you have some other protocol. So even the initial design of the Sprint thing was supposed to be using Corba for some of the connections and using proprietary, very narrow and very customized socket interfaces for some of the other components. Like the backend, like talking to the network elements and the network switches was all using these telecom protocols.
Yeah, I've been inside multiple telcos, and they all seem to have that kind of mix. They do Corba for some things, and they all, every single one of them I've ever been in, has some kind of proprietary messaging scheme of one sort or another that they use for what you're talking about, where they're doing that kind of message passing. And usually it involves a mainframe on the other end, is my experience.
Well, the good thing about telcos is they're so standardized. They have 1,000 standards for everything. So sometimes they're using SNMP, sometimes they're using some sort of TINA-C standard, this or that, but they got all these four-letter acronyms, and they just come in and throw stacks of them on the chairs of some unsuspecting software engineer to interface to.
Well, you know, if one standard's no good, you've always got plenty of others to choose from then, right?
Well, the funny thing was that this was the second time this had happened to me, that we were kind of getting draft versions of a standard and just implementing them and testing them, and then we gave feedback to the standard writers, and they say, well, how do you know that? And we said, well, we tested it, and this is what happened. And it turns out they were just doing their standards. The same thing happened with David Leibs and me when we were working at Xerox together with Sun. And Sun was trying to specify open look, that look and feel that they had.
Oh, I remember that.
Textos. And they would send us versions of the doc, and we'd write back, that looks terrible. And they'd say, what do you mean? In the paint program, it looks great. And we said, yes, but in the widget, this turnaround time for them to make changes in C++ and have tests they could look at was much longer than what David Leibs could have in ObjectWorks at the time.
Yeah. Now, I remember OpenLook. I actually used, there was a widget library, I can't remember the name of it now, but back in SunOS, there was a widget library that might have even been influenced by the stuff you're talking about, because I remember as a C programmer thinking it was fairly easy to work with. But this is going way back now.
Well, I pity you if you're a C programmer at that time.
Well, that was back in the 80s. I was a C programmer for about 5 years, late 80s. No, I learned Smalltalk. Actually, the funny thing is I was at a company called Booz Allen and Hamilton, a consulting company, and they had lost the guy who was doing Smalltalk training for them as on a contract for Park Place. And I had gotten tossed off a contract, so I was in between jobs for Booz Allen, and they had lost their guy who was doing Smalltalk training. And they looked at my resume, and somewhere in the bowels of my resume was the fact that I'd been a school teacher. So they said, well, you don't know Smalltalk, but you've been a teacher. And they dug up some other guy who'd done some Digitalk for a year and said, okay, this guy knows Smalltalk, but he's never taught. So between the two of you, you guys can figure it out. Well, you know, it's your typical big consulting company mindset. So they threw the two of us in a room. And I remember we were trying to teach Intro to VisualWorks on machines that had 8 megabytes of memory. And they were just barely fast enough to sort of kind of handle VisualWorks 1.0. And that was where I started, was with VisualWorks 1.0 at Booz Allen in Maryland.
Talking about being memory starved.
Yeah, you couldn't open too many things, or things got really, really slow. And this was on Windows 3.1, or no, it might have been Windows for Workgroups. It was either on 3.1 or Windows for Workgroups. I can't remember which. So, I mean, it was, heck, I still remember back when I was a sales engineer, when Visual Wave first shipped, you might remember that Visual Wave, the first thing that Park Place shipped. I remember doing demos for people where the only way I could get a demo to work on my one laptop, because Windows for Workgroups had socket capability, but the sockets would drop if you lost your network connection. They just wouldn't work. So I'd have to dial into the server, into the Park Place server, and then pull the phone line out without telling it I was hanging up, and then that would fool Windows into thinking it still had a network connection. Close the lid, drive to the customer site where I was doing the demo, and hope that the machine's battery didn't die between the time I got in the car and the time I arrived. It was a whole different world back then.
So this other, I don't know, I was thinking about that, the list of topics I sent you before, and one other thing that I think is still maybe interesting, and it's been on your podcast recently, was sort of the demise of Pollock and people looking at what has now become called Wrapper, but just the VisualWorks framework, what differentiated VisualWorks from ObjectWorks, and both in terms of the widget set and the structured graphics underpinnings and how you do tool composition. And I think it's a perfect time to start talking that over again now that everybody's saying, well, if we're going to live with Wrapper, let's fix it. Or I think add a couple features or refactor a few things so that Wrapper would be easier to use versus moving everything over to all graphics being OpenGL or something else. You mentioned before native widgets. Well, that's one thing that has helped me a lot, was that in my very early years with Smalltalk, because I had already been doing structured graphics in Lisp and with these CAD/CAM programs. I just wrote, you know, a 3 or 4 line set of classes for display item and display list, and then display item has subclasses for circles and squares and texts and images and whatever. And that's why I've been able to port the code both between every version of VisualWorks and then over to Squeak and then back from Squeak. And one version I had a couple of years, I had a version of it in Java. And the idea that we just things like HotDraw or the June graphics, I think it's maybe high time to get structured graphics and windowing rethought through and merged again. And I know people are talking at least for a while about, oh, when we get the Pollock browser or the Pollock tools. So maybe...
Well, the interesting thing is, I think we internally here at CINCOM, we ended up talking down about the current GUI and widget set much more than we needed to, based on the whole notion that Pollock was going to come in and save the day. And, you know, if you've been reading, I don't know if you follow them, but if you read either Travis Griggs' blog or Michael Lucas Smith's blog, they both talked about working with the existing UI stuff. And if you go up to where Visual Part is their contention, things don't have to be as ugly in the framework as the GUI building tools would have you believe they are.
Right.
And part of that, interestingly, from what I understand, at least this was the version of reality I heard from John Brusis, who was the product manager back at Park Place in the early 90s. From what I understand, back when ObjectWorks 4.1 and VisualWorks 1.0 shipped, there was initially no real GUI builder and no real generator for code to link the GUI builder with the stuff, you know, with any application model. And a large part of the code that is currently the UI builder and the UI painter is just a partially cleaned up set of workspace scripts that David Leibs had lying around.
Well, it was from this project that David Leibs and I and a couple other people had been doing for the Spooks that was called the Navigator. And there's some references online about the Navigator for Unix. We actually made a demo video of it for SigKai Computer Human Interaction. But that was code that, out of political reasons at Park, we always had to say, we're developing this for the Spooks on a consulting contract. This is not meant to go into the main development branch. And then lots of other stuff happened that was supposed to be what was the new graphics and windowing framework for the development branch. But suddenly the time came and the only framework that worked and the only GUI builder that could be used was this one that David had written that kind of, it wasn't written quickly as a bunch of scripts, but it wasn't written to be intended for use in the main development path either.
Okay.
So it's something that was really written for David and me to use to write all these tools for the Spooks and kind of then got cleaned up rather quickly to be the general thing. But if you look at those old videos from the late 80s of the Navigator for Unix, it's all there. It just wasn't called VisualWorks, and it was made for this other set. I was kind of trying to replace the Analyst. I don't know if you know of that. It was an old...
I know of the Analyst, yeah.
They wanted to move off the Analyst and get onto more modern stuff. So we wrote them this thing that was supposed to be kind of a proof of concept. And then suddenly, you know, much to David's surprise, it ended up being the GUI framework and GUI toolset for the standard image, and that was its original design, I promise.
So the translation I heard ultimately through John Brusis, and I think I heard it secondhand, not from John, but from somebody who was telling me what he...
This is very close, yeah.
Is close, but not completely true. What we've got is ultimately, the GUI building side of it is a prototype that nobody, at least in the technical side of things, really intended to ship as product.
Right. A concept to show them what they could have that would have been better than Analyst.
Uh-huh.
The idea that they could have people building their own tools to do this kind of data mining, which is what their particular job was.
Okay.
And we merged these other packages we had already, and so a lot of the weird naming about some things are called adapters and other things are called wrappers, and there's like this merge of several different naming conventions, even the design patterns, is just that David and I both had these different packages that we were merging parts of, and so wrapper and adapter and all those different names just are somebody should have cleaned that up if they knew it was going to see the light of day.
So that's why you have that level of confusion still in parts of that framework, is that, again, it wasn't really intended to be shipped, at least by you guys who were working on the prototypes. It wasn't really intended to ship as product. It just got shipped out the door.
But I know that David has always said, and I'm happy to hear if Travis and Michael are saying it, that, you know, with a few days' work or a few staff months of effort, it is what we need. It's just a little arcane and it both has a couple extra things and a couple things done wrong and a couple missing things. But if somebody fixed that, wrapper should work. And wrapper is fundamentally done the right way. And maybe to get back to something I was saying earlier, actually, if you used species for multiple inheritance, so that half of the layers of wrappers, you know, either border decorators or a lot of those things could become species inheritance. It would simplify your window composition greatly.
Yeah, this is actually probably a conversation that I really wish Michael were on the line for, because this is a topic that he feels fairly strongly about, and I'd love to have his opinion on this. And it'll probably end up being a topic of conversation next time we have a podcast, because he'll want to expand on his translation of whatever you're saying, whatever my responses are. And what he's going to really tell me is, Jim, why didn't you ask X, Y, Z, and A, alpha, beta, gamma?
Well, I know I've heard on just previous podcasts of yours here that people were talking about wrapper being, you know, worth saving, even if Pollock is not happening, that's not bad. And actually transitioning it forward would have the advantage of not breaking people's apps. Speaking as a person with a lot of apps, I was looking at Pollock saying, okay, I'm going to let them get it really finished. So first of all, I was going to be one of those customers who doesn't transition for 2 or 3 years. And then I was going to whine about it even then.
Well, that was ultimately one of the main reasons we ended up doing what we did, was that we were hearing low-level grumbling from a fair number of customers, and then we were looking at what Widgetry or Pollock was compared to what we already had, and we decided that the cost-benefits ratio just didn't add up. That's really where we came down on it.
Well, now I wish I had studied it more, so I could have talked more about it in the interim stages before. You know, I was just waiting for it to be done.
Yeah. Well, most people who weren't tightly involved just didn't get involved in that conversation because, like you, they said they basically decided they had better things to be doing in the interim, building their applications, doing what they needed to do, and didn't want to be having to study something that might impact them badly unless they had to.
Yeah, I think, well, but at any rate, getting back to the thing that I'm doing still a lot in Siren that is could be easier is just using the tools as composable. You know, adding a few extra widgets and then being able to reuse things like refactoring browsers or debuggers or higher level dialogues. And that was one thing that was also that I liked when I went back to Squeak was, oh, that's right, they have the old real simple browser instead of 16 layers of policies and wrappers and navigators and attitude objects and stuff that three times I've given up even just adding a couple menu items to the browser now because I can't figure out what navigator or policy interface visitor actually sets up a menu item.
Yeah, well, you know, in terms of the refactoring browser, the main problem it has is not really even a Syncom Smalltalk specific problem. It's that when it was written specifically to be cross Smalltalk dialect so that you could have the refactoring browser in VisualWorks and in Squeak and in Visual Age and in, I think there's a version in BSE and there was a version in Dolphin. So there's this whole layer that you're talking about to some extent that at some level, if you were just saying, I want a refactoring browser for Dolphin or I want one for Squeak or I want one for VisualWorks, if you were writing just that, you wouldn't have most of that stuff. But the idea behind it was, let's make it so that it works in all these dialects. So there's that portability layer floating in the middle that, you know, from your perspective, I guess gets in the way.
Well, if you just want to build, you know, a database interface or a file-based browser where what shows up in the bottom pane isn't code, but audio or images or something, you can't really reuse much of that. You end up going back to Squeak and porting over the old browser MVC model.
Yep, no, I know what you're talking about. And that actually, the last little while, I know Travis has been working on trying to simplifying the browser somewhat. And I haven't looked at the technical details of that, but I know that he's been trying to get some of the stuff that makes the refactoring browser harder to work with go away.
I guess it wouldn't take long just using the GUI painter to make a kind of a template or a customizable browser that just says, I've got four lists and, you know, you just have to implement the messages category, class, protocol, and message to be whatever you want. And, you know, the way the old, it wouldn't be hard to do, make something like the old fashioned browser.
No, it shouldn't be that hard. I mean, people have done it as demonstration code. I mean, actually, if you look in the inspector, the Trippy inspector, it has a recapitulation of the browser built into it because the browser in the inspector is not the refactoring browser. It's a simplified version of the browser, and probably it's more or less what you're talking about.
I'll have to go look at that. Speaking of Trippy inspector, do people use these object editors and navigators, and is there a tree-based widget for pulling things apart that's usable?
Well, interestingly enough, not in VisualWorks, there's not. In Object Studio, the inspector is actually a very interestingly nice tree inspector.
That's not what I wanted to hear, Jim. Come on.
Actually, the inspector is something that I know Travis is interested in. So actually, if you have ideas for the inspector, things you'd like it to do, probably a good thing to do would be to send a message to VWNC, because I know he's paying attention to that kind of stuff.
Okay. I've used other ones in other small talks and things that, where stuff.
Yeah, but out. I know that specifically the browser and the inspector, and for that matter, the debugger, there's planned enhancements to all those things, but none of it's set in concrete or stone. So the idea is that if you have things you'd like to see, I can't guarantee they're going to come in, but certainly if you have ideas of things you'd like to see in those tools, just push them in.
Well, then, I'll say it now and send it out as a message. My comment would just be less enhancements, less features, but more reusability of the basic core implementation. So you can make application-specific tools based on reusing the system's own browsers and inspectors and editors, right? The old MVC idea was you have these sort of generic things called browsers and inspectors and editors, and then what we called Navigator MVC was just saying, you add those extra objects, and some of them may use different kinds of design patterns to get at the underlying model and the underlying statefulness of the editor, but you get much higher level of reusability even than just reusing, list views and button panel kind of widgets.
Well, actually, some of those ideas are that kind of approach of trying to simplify the browser and inspector and debugger from that perspective. A lot of that is on tap as something that I know that Travis and Michael and a few others would like to do. And the reason for that is that if you were to look into the guts of the browser and the inspector and the debugger...
But you're saying this is things that other people are trying to do, and so that's good news.
Yeah. Well, the thing is that they want to simplify that stuff, because one of the problems with the inspector and the debugger and the browser right now is if you were to look into the innards of them, they're all using a different parser.
No!
which all by itself is kind of an entertaining problem.
Entertaining you all that, okay.
and part of what we'd like to see happen is for that to be unified. I mean, this is sort of the same problem writ large in a way that we have with the Corba stuff and our web services stack and Visual Wave, is that they were all at one point using different server frameworks, and that's at least starting to merge into one. And we have the same problem with our tools, is that since some of the tools were integrated from outside, like the debugger came from outside, and while the inspector came from inside, the browser came from outside too. So you had the browser, inspector, and debugger done by three different people with three different notions of how things ought to be done.
Man.
And they don't really unify. I mean, at least even until recently, many of the menu items didn't even match. So that's at least starting to get cleaned up. And yeah, that's a major problem that we intend to address, because it is very confusing. I mean, even, for old timers, it's very confusing. Never mind neophytes.
And just the fact that you don't just treat the tools as being reusable, customizable applications, where a lot of apps say we grab this pane out of the debugger to show us something, or we, compose our tool with a couple of inspectors just plugged right into it. That's what I try to do with the music tools, with this kind of music-specific widget set that I have. And whenever I give demos, I go out of my way to show the evolution of a couple of tools, like a simple notation editor, the fancy one, or, simple sound editor, and then something, a tool that composes a couple of sound editors and lets you do crossfades. And I always make the point to people, say, the difference between that app that I showed you and this app is two pages of code. Uh-huh. And I've gone to demos where I take the two pages and say, this is it, to make one of these groovy tools. And that wows people, the idea of having generic applications and reusable frameworks that where you can really get that, the promise of a lot of modern software engineering. And if our own tools were something that every Smalltalk programmer just new were components that were easy to embed in something.
Oh, it imposes costs on everybody. I mean, one of the things that I know drove Gemstone Bats was when we integrated the new debugger on the new browser. It made their lives actually more difficult.
Well, yeah, you just had that recent podcast where they were talking about their tools and running Gemstone browsers in Smalltalk versus in their VM having Squeaker or VisualWorks wrappers that are really just transparent then, and where all you're looking at is Gemstone code.
Right.
Which, if they had done that in the 80s, I wouldn't be programming in Smalltalk anymore. So I'd just be a Gemstone programmer.
Well, you'd still be a Smalltalk programmer. You'd just be an object database Smalltalk programmer.
Exactly. I'd be a GPS programmer.
There you go.
No, we used Gemstone here for a while. We went through just about every... we did Corba for a couple of years on our apps. We did Mini Store on some apps. We've kind of been been around just trying things. You know, we failed wonderfully at many different attempts to make bigger performances or louder music or more complicated compositions or more interactivity. But along the way, saw some things where we said, boy, you know, if that scaled, things would be so much better. Or if that were stable, or if we could do it that way and really have it work.
So what do you use for data storage these days? If you're not using Gemstone, what do you use?
Just Postgres mostly, just SQL. But it describes, I mean, our real data is all just in raw files. So we have, you know, databases of metadata, and they just point to AIFF and movie files and stuff. So we're not actually putting audio in the databases, but we have tons and tons of metadata that has pointers to things. So a lot of times, if you have a whole lot of audio, you'll just keep it in an iTunes database. And there are scripts that can do things like pull names out of iTunes or do queries against iTunes just using AppleScript, and then all of the metadata just lives in Postgres.
Actually, you could pull that out with Smalltalk fairly easily because all the iTunes metadata is just XML anyway.
Exactly. Just we had one student that wrote us a bunch of Apple scripts that we just, to this day, are too lazy to move away from. They still work.
Actually, for me, the bigger problem with audio is one that I don't know if you have, maybe you do have an answer for. There's something I did recently. We've been doing this podcast for just over a year now.
Congratulations. Yes, I heard the 50th show.
When I did that compilation, I put that compilation together in the stupidest way possible. I took and loaded each individual podcast into Audacity and kind of fast-forwarded through and hoped that I would hit interesting snippets, and if I did, copy and paste them into another Audacity file. And one of the things that would be kind of useful, and it's hard because for a compilation, you're kind of looking for interesting things that you don't know are there. But even if I knew, well, I'm looking for a phrase, finding that in an audio file, at least with the tools that I tend to have lying around, is not at all easy. You know, if I knew I was having a conversation, for instance, about a specific topic, and I think it's in one of these three audio files.
No real speech understanding that could help you very far with that is still a ways away.
Yeah.
There's segmenting. I mean, you could certainly have programs that would go through and find changes of speakers or find pauses longer than some amount or clicking sounds that, you know, you could certainly segment a podcast pretty well into phrases and sentences and speakers.
Right.
But finding a specific phrase is still, that's especially since these don't have super controlled and super equal audio quality.
Right.
You know, speech understanding works for very limited, carefully controlled recordings and training. But I guess since you guys do this all the time, you could certainly train each of you separately, train a transcription system on your voices and your microphones, right?
Yeah. Well, actually, transcription, interestingly enough, there are transcription services if I wanted to do that.
Well, no, IBM has the VoiceIt, and there are commercial products, so that if you have a good mic and train the software, you can speak into it and it transcribes it.
Yeah. I know there's software that does that, but there are also transcription services that I think what they're actually doing is paying legions of underpaid labor somewhere on the planet to listen to your audio and then transcribe it. Because it has to be fairly underpaid labor for the cheap prices they charge.
Well, it's the big problem that everybody has is capturing, whether it's capturing video or whatever, that you'd have the capture, and then separately you have a thing on logging.
Right.
And so, you know, for the next year, if you just, at the end of each of these podcasts, if you took 2 minutes and just added some commentary to a logging file with some timestamps,
yeah.
You know, that's what they do when they're shooting miles of video footage, which of course isn't even miles of footage anymore. It's just on a hard disk.
Right.
If you haven't logged it really carefully or have somebody there doing logging while you're capturing.
So basically, if I wasn't lazy.
Well, no, you could certainly rig up whatever your recording program is so you could be setting markers
right.
of different flavors while you're recording the podcast.
Right. Yeah, I could do that even in something as simple as Audacity. I know I could
sure.
be doing that.
You have a special button that inserts an emoticon in the audio that says, this one's for the bloopers reel.
All right. Well, with that little soliloquy, I think we've been rambling for almost an hour.
Oh, time flies when you're as old as I am, I think. Something like
that. I think I'm going to cut it here and go and say hello to my family.
Well, please say hello to them for me and tell Michael and David they're complete scoundrels.
I will.
I will rematch. That's it.
Yeah, I will enjoy telling Michael he's a scoundrel.
Oh, you just, well, not in that way. No, that's not the way I meant. But hey, it's wonderful to hear your voice, and I am a fan. So thank you very much for making the for misinterpreting everything.
Oh, that's what I do.
Yeah, it's a service to the community. That's what I'll say.
All right. Thanks, Stephen.
Thanks a lot.
Yeah. Bye.
Bye.
Next is Dave Buck with this week's Cimbron Design Minute.
This is David Buck with today's Cimbron Design Minute. Version control is critical if you're developing professional software, but just having version control isn't enough. You need to have version control practices that will ensure that your development remains under control. Can you easily reload your application from the version control system? If it's a difficult process to reload your code, developers will be reluctant to do it frequently. Do you baseline frequently? Can you easily load the system as it looked last week or the week before? Can you see what changes occurred between last week's baseline and the current version? Do you store non-source code files in the repository and track their versions as you do source code? These are all targets you should strive to meet in order to make your development predictable and to reduce the risk in your project. This has been the Cimbron Design Minute. Cimbron offers training and consulting in object-oriented languages and the Smalltalk programming language. For more information, visit www.cimbron.com or email info@cimbron.com.
And here is James Savage with this week's Smalltalk Jobs Report.
I'm James T. Savage, and this is the Smalltalk Jobs Report. I've been contributing the Jobs Report to the Industry Misinterpretations podcast for over a year now, and I've decided to take a bit of a vacation. Today I'm recording the segment from sunny Galveston, Texas. I originally tried recording this on the beach, but the wind was a bit much for my microphone. Bruce Enel, our contributor in the EU, reports that there are three new positions available in Europe. In Paris, France, or remotely, there is a 1.5-month contract position for someone who has experience with Croquet. Also in Paris, there is a permanent position open for programming natural disaster simulations using VisualWorks. In Cologne, Germany, there is a permanent position for a VisualWorks developer who speaks German and also has experience with OOAD and UML. Back in the U.S., in San Jose, California, Koa Networks is advertising for a senior QA analyst to work on black box testing of commercial applications. They are looking for someone who has a wide range of experience with testing tools and with systems built with VisualWorks. On a final note this week, our condolences go out to all the Australian Smalltalkers who lost their jobs this past week because of the large layoffs at Wizard. We will continue to post Australian Smalltalk jobs as we become aware of them. If there is someone from Down Under that would be willing to help us track the Australian jobs, please contact me via my blog, Message Sends, with an undefined object. Good luck with your job hunting.
And that wraps up my two-part conversation with Stephen Travis Pope. Hope you enjoyed that. As always, if you have feedback, send it to smalltalkpodcasts@syncom.com. Head on over to Facebook and look at the Industry Misinterpretations group. Head on over to iTunes and leave a review, or Podcast Alley and cast a vote. Till next week, have fun with Smalltalk.